Welcome to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. Computers and the internet have brought conveniences to our lives, to be sure, but wouldn't you sometimes love to go back to the days before passwords? Well, forget about it. Now we have to assume our passwords are never safe, exposing our personal information to who knows who. Who knows who, because just about anybody can crack a password, or that is according to Nate Anderson, the deputy editor at the website Ars Technica. He's with us today to talk about his recent one-day experiment in cracking passwords. Welcome to the show, Nate.
Thanks for having me.
You said that password cracking is approaching entry-level kiddie stuff. What do you mean by that?
Well, I'm sure everyone listening has heard, you know, legions of stories over the last few years over passwords for websites being cracked, people breaking into accounts. I've heard about it. I cover it. And I wanted to kind of actually try it for myself and see just how easy is this. The tools to do it are widely available. They're free. The word lists that you need to do it, widely available. So everything's out there, and I wanted to see how difficult was it for somebody who's not really a hacker. I'm definitely more of a journalist than a hacker. And, you know, could I do this in a few hours and achieve any success? And it turns out I could.
You set some goals for yourself or some limitations for yourself. Can you tell us about that?
Well, the basic goal was to limit myself to the sorts of hardware and software that anybody could get access to. So I used a pair of fairly old laptops, nothing fancy. I used free software I downloaded over the internet, so I paid no money for anything I did. And I was trying to see if I could, you know, start from scratch and end by cracking a bunch of passwords within the space of a single day.
What is a password cracker? What are you actually cracking?
So what you're cracking in these cases, if you were to break into a website, for instance, and try to steal passwords, what you would get are not people's actual passwords. But almost every website on earth keeps the passwords in encrypted form, and these are called hashes. They've been passed through a special mathematical function that can only operate one way, so you can't go backward from the hash to the password. This provides a little bit of extra security. So what you get when you do this is this long list of lines of text that are basically, they look like random characters to you and I. And so what you can get is a program that will go through trying billions of combinations a second, trying to match up passwords that it starts with a hash on the other end. And if it has a match, it knows what the initial password was.
My guest is Nate Anderson. He's deputy editor at ArsTechnica.com, and we're talking about cracking passwords or cracking hashes. If you have a question or comment for Nate, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. So you needed a password cracker. How easy is it to get one?
So these are freely available. There are tools with names like John the Ripper or Hashcat. They're designed specifically for this. They can take advantage, if you have a newer computer, they can take advantage of the graphics cards within those computers to crack passwords at just almost literally unbelievable rates. I mean, we are talking billions of passwords a second they can run through. So very powerful programs, free of charge. Anyone can download them on the internet. And, you know, I should say there's nothing inherently wrong about these programs. Many mm-hmm. people use them to recover their own passwords that they have forgotten, for instance. Mm-hmm. So there's all sorts of legitimate uses for them.
So who puts these things together? Who puts these programs together? Who provides them?
Various groups of coders, the people behind Hashcat, have not really wanted their identities known. They go by certain usernames. So it just varies by the tool. But there are so many of these tools out there that it's not a problem to find one.
You also needed to find a set of high-quality word lists. What are word lists, and what do they do? What do they have to do with cracking the hashes?
Well, so there's two simple ways to think about cracking a password. One is called brute force. That's where you start with a password, say A, 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 and then you try A, 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 B, and you just iterate through every combination. As you can imagine, that is incredibly time intensive, especially as passwords get longer. So the much better way is to start with something called a word list. And it's really just a list of words. It can be every word in the dictionary, for instance. You can get word lists for other languages. But the best word list is if you can get a huge list of passwords that people have actually used, because those tend to be very common. They tend to be reused. And it so happens that we have word lists like this due to some high-profile hacking incidents in the last couple of years. And there's a really famous one called the RockYou word list. It's got millions of actual passwords that people used. And you can start running that word list against your hashes, and you will usually crack 30, 40, 50% of them in 1 minute, 2 minutes, 3 minutes.
You said that in the interest of speeding up with password cracking, you would start with a particular easy-to-use forum, and that you began with an unsalted MD5 hashed passwords. What do you mean by unsalted?
So this gets a bit more technical. There are all sorts of ways that cracking passwords can be made more difficult, and one of them is something called salting. For instance, you know, I guarantee that everybody listening, their bank would use this technique, but some websites don't. It's a way of making it more difficult to calculate these hashes. And so I was just using the simplest form of hashed passwords just to see how possible this was, how easy it was. But most legitimate websites would have made my job far harder, and they do that by making it take far longer for your computer to do this, therefore making it, you know, less feasible to crack all these various hashed passwords that you have.
Francis in Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome to the show, Francis.
Hi. I have a question and a comment about these passwords. My heritage is from the Czech Republic. So what I have used for various passwords have been descriptions like mother, daughter, grandmother, sister, whatever, but I've used the Czech words for those, and I'm wondering how good that is, or if anybody else has thought about doing something like that. There it is.
That's a great question. You know, my wife is actually speaks Czech as well, and she has done the same thing.
Oh, really?
Yeah, replacing English words that are easy for her to remember with Czech equivalents, adding some numbers in there, that sort of thing. But there's still common words in Czech, and so it really depends on what tools the person trying to crack your passwords is using. If somebody was using a word list that included many Czech users, for instance, those types of passwords would tend to be in that list, and your password would be cracked very, very, very easily. So it really just depends what people are using. I mean, the gold standard is really not using any words that can be found in any sort of a dictionary, and it would be purely random characters, numbers, letters, and symbols. The problem is that's really, really hard for humans to remember.
Okay, Francis, you're on to something.
Well, so far it's worked. Let's put it that way.
All right, good luck.
Thank you.
We have a comment from a listener. They ask, when you say that you cracked thousands of passwords in one day, are we talking passwords like password or dog, or are we talking truly complicated passwords?
No, many of these were fairly complicated passwords. They were long passwords. They often had numbers in them. They often had a mix of uppercase and lowercase letters and symbols. It was pretty much the complete range. And that's because I wasn't trying to do a brute force attack. As I said, a brute force attack cycles through every letter and every character and every number and gets longer and longer. And when you get up to 10, 11, 12 character passwords, that becomes just infeasible. I mean, it would have taken my computer 10 months to run one of those on 10 character passwords. But when you use these word lists, if the password is in the word list, it will be cracked almost instantly. It doesn't matter how complicated it is. So if you have a password that anybody else has thought of before that is in these common word lists, it really doesn't matter how long it is. If it's in the list, it will be broken.
After you cracked thousands of passwords, you tried to crack your own. What happened?
I did. I had been using an old password for many years on my personal computer. This isn't on a website or anything. Mm-hmm. So it would be very hard for people to get to. But I still wanted to just check how secure it was. It fell instantly. It turns out it was in the word list I was using. And it was just a real wake-up call that, again, like I said, it doesn't matter how complicated the password is. If it's in one of these word lists, it will go in a couple of seconds.
Is the fact that OSU every, I don't know how many weeks it is, we have to refresh our or redo our passwords every, like, I don't know, maybe 3 or 4 months or something like that. Is that what they're trying to avoid, are these word lists?
Well, they're trying to avoid a situation in which somebody steals all the passwords and then doesn't use them for a few months. So they make it more difficult. So say somebody stole all your passwords, and then it took them a while to crack it. By the time they cracked it, you may have changed your password, so it wouldn't matter anymore. There's some debate in security circles about whether this is good practice or not, simply because it causes people so much confusion about what their password is at any given time.
Hello,
they start writing it down, mm-hmm. or they start choosing very simple passwords that are actually easier to guess. So that's a contentious topic at the moment.
Mike in Columbus, you're on the air with Nate Anderson, deputy editor of ArsTechnica.com.
Hi, am I on?
You're on, Mike.
Well, I've got a concept here. I'd like to run by the gentleman. But I have a question first. It seems to me that, like, the length of the password would make the thing a little more difficult. But here's my thought. I don't think of a password as a word. I think of it kind of like a fingerprint, which translates in my mind into a thought print. And so my process for making a password is to take an obscure line from a poem, musical, song, book, movie, whatever, and the long one that I like a lot, but nobody knows I know it or like it, or nobody knows the movie ever existed, or say. And then I take the first letter or second letter or pick a number. I take, say, the first letter of each word. I write them down till I have about 15 or so, 20 characters. And then I capitalize a set according to a formula that I use. Doubles, one of them will be capital and the other one will be lowercase, and the third one might be a number, the number of that word in the alphabet, maybe, you know. And it goes on and on and on. I go through layers of altering these, but it all comes back to that phrase that I will not forget and the pattern that I can, that I do consistently use. Huh. So I'm going to get off the air now and see if I'm full of baloney or if I got something here.
Thanks, Mike. What do you think, Nate?
Well, that sounds like that's going to produce a very, very, very strong password. So that's terrific. The downside is just how much work that is to generate. You know, if that works for you, you know, more power to you. But yes, that would be a terrific result.
So the length of a password helps protect it just in general?
Well, in general. But again, if, say, you're using a very, very long English word with two numbers at the end, the combination of a word plus two numbers at the end is one of the most common combinations that people use to generate passwords. And every password cracker has what are called these rule lists, where they can take every word in the dictionary and add two numbers to the end of them, and they will try every combination that way. So, you know, the length isn't the best thing on its own to think about password security, because if you're using common words, it doesn't matter how long they are because they're going to be in these word lists. Length does matter if you're using a fully randomized password, so just a random, you know, meaningless collection of letters and numbers and symbols. And at that point, every character you add makes it exponentially more difficult for a computer to crack. And if you're above 11 or 12 characters, there's almost no chance that even the most powerful computers are going to crack that in the next few years.
An email from a listener, they say, I use a free password safe called KeePass. It generates user-configurable strings of characters of any user-specified length. This would be less vulnerable to word list-type cracks. I also have also generated these kinds of passwords using the random function of spreadsheets. However, it is easier to store other account info in KeePass. Is KeePass a sort of a password manager that you referred to in your article?
It is. It's okay. One of them. There are many of these programs, and they deal with this exact situation. The best passwords are, say, 25-character random strings, but no human's going to remember that. So there are now these password managers that can generate those strings and keep them for you and keep them safe, and then all you need to remember is the one master password. So that is kind of where password security has been going. And there are many different ways to use these things, but they do come with their own downsides as well. For instance, trying to use them on say, your iPad or your Android phone can sometimes be a little more tricky. So you need to think about how you want to use them and what might work best for you.
Well, Nate Anderson, thanks for joining us today to talk about it.
Great. Thanks for having me on.
Nate Anderson is the deputy editor of ArsTechnica.com. We'll have a link to his article on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. We'll be right back with Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Dan Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
We're trying to untangle the social safety net, where the term came from and what it means to different people.
All those with true need can rest assured that the social safety net of programs they depend on are exempt from any cuts.
I'm Sarah Gardner, a brief safety net history, next on Marketplace from 8 p.m.
Marketplace tonight at 6 on 89.7 NPR News. 34 degrees with some sunshine and a high of 41 today. Clear skies tonight, a low of 24, more sunshine and a high of 46 on Wednesday. Support comes from Assistive Technology of Ohio. AT Ohio is now accepting donations of used computers to be refurbished and made available to Ohioans with disabilities. AT Ohio offers a variety of disability programs and services, including a device loan library. Donation information is at atohio.org. And support comes from Clintonville Academy. Pre-kindergarten through 8th grades, Clintonville Academy now participates in the Ed Choice Scholarship Program and is accepting applications until April 12th. More information online at clintonvilleacademy.org. Small school, smart choices. All Sides continues. This is 89.7 NPR News.
Welcome back to Tech Tuesday on All Sides. The company Mozilla first made a name for itself by offering free open software alternatives. Their browser Firefox gained popularity as a quicker, more secure option for PC users looking to replace Microsoft's Internet Explorer. Now Mozilla has set its sights on smartphones and is introducing an operating system to compete with Apple and Android phones. Joining us now to discuss Mozilla's effort and other smartphone news is Parmi Olson, who covers technology for Forbes magazine. Welcome back to the show, Parmi.
Hi, thank you.
So Google's Android or Apple's operating systems together control 85% of the market now. Even Microsoft has managed only 3% market share with its Windows Mobile. How can Firefox... Are you there? Okay, we've just lost Parmi Olson. So we'll get her back in just a second. If you have a question or comment, though, about the operating systems on the smartphones, on the smartphone that you use, give us a call, 614-292-8513. Or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You can also use our Facebook page and post your question or comment there. You can tweet us at WOSU All Sides. We have lots of options for you. We'll be coming up later. We'll be talking about the latest iteration of the 3D printer, with Russell Holly, yet another 3D printer. This one apparently something you could give somebody for Christmas. I'm still not sure whether you can fit it into a bread box or not. 614-292-8513 is the number to call, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. Welcome back, Parmi.
Hi.
Okay.
I don't know what happened there.
I don't know if you caught what I was saying. Google.
Sure.
Google, the Android and the Apple, they control 85% of the market. Microsoft, just 3%, and it's Microsoft with Windows Mobile. How can Firefox make a mark in that kind of a competitive arena?
Well, it's going to be very difficult. This is a brutal marketplace. And as you were saying, even Microsoft, which is thought to have spent tens of millions of dollars just on marketing its new Windows Phone operating system, still only has about 3% of the global market. So the big challenge is to break this duopoly between Android and Apple. And it's just been so successful. iPhones have been so successful. Android phones have been so successful. Samsung is the big Android phone that everybody wants to own. So it's a huge challenge for Mozilla. But for them, they're unique in that they're not for profit. So
which I didn't know.
Profit organization. Most of their money comes from a search deal they have with Google. So if you have Firefox, the browser, on your desktop computer and you install it, you'll find that when you open it up, the homepage is a Google search bar. And so for doing that, they earn, well, they haven't told us specifically how much they get from that deal, but it's the vast majority of the revenue they made. In 2011, it was something like $160 million, and most of that came from their deal with Google. So that's how they make their money. They plow it all back into the organization. They're not for profit. And they say, you know, our goal here isn't to make money. It's not even that we want to be number one or we want our name to be out there. We just want to push what they call the open web. So their point is that when we go online through our mobile phones, we do so oftentimes through apps. Now, to get an app, you have to go through a store, if it's Apple's App Store or Google's App Store called Google Play. And they're saying you shouldn't have to do that. You shouldn't have to pay money to some gatekeeper to access the mobile web. It should be free and open. And so the way that their new phone will work when it comes out later this year in emerging markets is you to go on the web instead of, you know, when you do a Google search, mm-hmm. you type in something like, I don't know, James Bond, and you get a bunch of web links and text that you can click on. On the phone, if you did a search, you would come up with apps. So the application grid would show up, those little colorful icons, instead of text, and you tap on those to open up an app. So the app becomes like the website. It's like the new website. So it's a very different way of thinking about how you go online through your mobile phone, a much more open way of searching and going online using apps.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. I'm talking with Parmi Olson, tech writer for Forbes magazine. So Mozilla wants to get involved because the future is mobile, right?
Absolutely. And I think everybody who you would speak to, not just in the mobile industry, but in the tech industry, will say exactly the same thing. Everybody wants to say that they're going mobile, that they, you know, if they're a handset manufacturer or device manufacturer, they are creating products that work with mobile phones. You know, there's smartphone penetration, or what we call smartphone penetration in the industry, is just exploding. There's millions of people buying smartphones every day. In the last year, there was 1 billion new smartphones came onto the market. People, 1 billion new smartphones were bought. So it's just huge growth. And that growth is kind of slowing in mature markets like the United States and Europe. But in emerging markets like South America, Africa, and parts of Asia, it's growing very, very fast.
Which is the strategy for Mozilla and Firefox and their Firefox operating system? Shoot for the emerging markets.
Exactly. And their phones, they're working already with quite a number of big-name manufacturers like Sony, LG Electronics, Alcatel, ZTE, Huawei, which is the big Chinese phone manufacturer, and they don't need to have powerful phones to run the software that they've created, this operating system. It's very light on mm-hmm. the phone, which is one reason why the phones would end up being much cheaper than other phones that are out there. So there's a big reason why they're targeting emerging markets, and their big goal is just to get more people online. So you've got, you know, another 2 billion people in the next few years who are kind of rising middle class. They're getting a little bit more money. Smartphones are becoming cheaper. And so finally, these are the new people who can actually buy a smartphone. And it's going to be through a smartphone that they have their very first experience with the internet. And Mozilla is saying, look, let's make it our phones. We want our phones to be how these people have their first experience with the internet and you know, access to all these other things that everyone else in the rest of the world has been able to have.
So Firefox operating system can make do with half the phone memory Android needs, for instance. The carriers can price a smartphone at that rate at well under $100, you wrote, and or half the price of a low-end Android smartphone. Is they're targeting the emerging markets for exactly the reasons you said, but could this, I mean, does this mean that we can't get it in the United States, or it just is going to be less desirable here, at least for the time being?
It is. They are planning to release phones in the United States, but that's not where they will be starting.
Okay.
So I would expect at least not till next year, 2014, that you would see any of these phones in the United States. Their real game plan is in emerging markets, so places like Mexico, Paraguay, Poland, in Eastern Europe, and just really focusing on those markets because, again, they can make the cheaper phone, and that's really where the growth is. And I think you see a lot of other mobile phone manufacturers are also focusing on emerging markets. You know, the big rumor, of course, is that the iPhone is going to get cheaper. iPhone, and a big reason for that, of course, is to harness that huge growth happening in emerging markets. And people in these markets need cheaper phones. They can't afford what we can afford here in the United States and in mature markets.
John in Columbus, you're on the air with Parmi Olson of Forbes. Welcome.
Thank you for the program today, Anne. My question is, it's my perception as a user, and this may not be reality, but my perception is that one of the values of having a relatively closed marketplace between the Google Play and the App Store on the Apple is that I'm at least assured that there's some security scanning going on, that I know that there's at least less of a likelihood of Trojans and viruses in the apps that I download. How does that play in an open marketplace?
That's a really great question, and I think this is one of the things that Apple and Google would say in their defense, that you need this walled garden. You know, you pay a little bit extra for that so that you have a good quality experience with the phone and more security. On the other hand, I think you can't deny that no matter who you are or how closely secure your walled garden is, you will be attacked by, or you will have hackers and you know, people with malicious intent, cyber criminals, doing what they can to find holes in those fences. So from what I've heard just from speaking to people in the cybersecurity industry, there are many attempts being made at finding at spreading malware to iOS devices, to iPhones, and of course Android is known to have there have been many attempts at spreading malware to Android devices. Even last week there was a targeted attack on Android phones. So I think, yes, it's true that certainly there are aspects where those kinds of phones and those kinds of devices would be more secure, but you can never be completely secure. And I think Mozilla would say that the more important thing, of course, is that there's just more opportunity for people to innovate on an open platform, on the open web, and that it would also be up to the device manufacturers to put in a certain to make sure that their own devices would be secure.
John, thanks a lot for that call. Just real quick, that recent malware attack on Android phones, it was the first of its kind. What happened before we let you go?
So what happened was some people at a Russian cybersecurity research company uncovered what they are saying is the first known targeted malware attack on Android phones. And this was against Tibetan activists. And they believe that the attack came from China. And the way that it worked is that the attackers sent emails to some of these activists, and they opened the email on their Android phone. And if the email had an attachment, if they downloaded the attachment, it turned into an app on their phone. And if they opened the app, which was, it was kind of like, it wasn't like a obvious that it was anything malicious. It was all very carefully constructed, so they thought that it was related to a conference that they were going to. Very clever. They opened the app, and it's some text related to a conference. And in the meantime, as they're opening it, it's this is actually malicious software that is collecting data from that person's phone, including contact details, text messages, SMS messages, call logs, geolocation, and sending that back eventually to a command and control server. So this is, they say that this is perhaps the beginning of other similar attacks on other Android phones, and they hadn't seen that kind of thing before, but they say it's perhaps a new wave of targeted attacks on Android users.
Oh, yay. Okay. Well, it's all good news, right, Parmi?
Well, I mean, in that instance, it was only focused on, who knows, maybe just a few dozen people, but the point is it's possible, mm-hmm. so it could happen to more in the future.
Right. Well, Parmi Olson, thanks for joining us today to talk about it. We really appreciate it.
My pleasure.
Parmi Olson, staff writer on technology for Forbes magazine. Coming up, Russell Holley will be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
During the Gaddafi regime, in 1990, Hisham Matar's father was kidnapped and sent to a Libyan prison for opposing the regime. Matar never saw his father again. After the fall of the Gaddafi regime, Matar returned to Libya, where he grew up, to investigate what happened to his father. On the next Fresh Air, he tells us what he learned, which he writes about in the current edition of The New Yorker. Join us.
And Fresh Air begins in just about 20 minutes, starting at noon. This is 89.7 NPR News. And the WOSE Public Media Member Card Benefit of the Month for April is the Ohio History Center. Enjoy 2-for-1 regular admission all month long. Support our station at the $85 level or more and receive your member card. Just visit WOSU.org. And thanks for your support of 89.7 NPR News. Sunshine today, a high near 41, clear skies tonight, and a low of 24 degrees. Support comes from Ohio State's Ross Heart Hospital, helping to build healthy hearts with the 2013 Wellness Series. Heart disease is the leading cause of death in the United States, and regular physical activity is a great way to prevent it. Details about Ohio State's Wellness Series are at go.osu.edu/series. All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Welcome back to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. Fans of the HBO fantasy series Game of Thrones were able to get their long-awaited fix last weekend with the premiere of the show's third season. Thanks to Microsoft's Smart Glass, fans of the Xbox 360 were also in luck, as they will now be able to stream the show. Here to tell us about this development and other technological/gadgetal news is Russell Holley, blogger for Geek.com. Welcome, Russell.
Hey, thanks for having me back.
So we've talked about it before, but refresh us. What is Smart Glass, and what does it have to do with this Game of Thrones?
So Microsoft has had the Xbox 360 loaded with digital content for a little while now. You can watch things from Netflix, from Amazon, and from a few other places. But you do everything with the Xbox controller. You have to have the Xbox controller to navigate everything. And Smart Glass is the way around that for the most part. You can use your smartphone or your tablet or anything like that. And as long as you're still on the same wireless network as the Xbox, then you can actually use it to control the stuff that's going on with your television through the Xbox. That's the stuff that we've talked about before.
Mm-hmm.
So what's new is the stuff that's exclusive through the Xbox Smart Glass interface for when you go to watch Game of Thrones on HBO through the HBO Go application on the Xbox. And what they've done now is given you a really interactive interface on your phone or on your tablet or even on your Windows 8 PC, if you've got a desktop that you've upgraded to Windows 8, where it takes all of the content and gives you a bunch of bonus stuff on your other screen, your kind of second screen. And for Game of Thrones, this means a map of Westeros that shows you where the different characters are, a bunch of added information for the coming season, where it breaks down the different characters and some of their backstory, and just a bunch of things that particularly were available in the book, but may not have been, you know, explained particularly well in the new show, you know, for whatever reason. Everyone always says the book is never as good as the movie or the TV show. And so this kind of blends those two together a little bit.
I can see how the maps would be really neat to have.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, it's a really cool experience. They just started with this first episode you can watch now on the HBO Go application. And in Smart Glass, they really did a cool job of placing, you know, exactly where everyone is. So it's easy to visualize right now, especially with so many of the main characters spread so far across, you know, with everything that's going on in the show. I'm not going to try not to talk a whole lot about the actual show.
No spoilers, right? Because is this happening with anything else, or is this the first experience like this?
Second screen applications are really kind of developing right now. There've been a couple of them that have been kind of cool, but none of them, you know, really have done the combination of things that are being done with the HBO Go app. You can get, you know, interactive maps for a couple of movies, and they'll play like on your iPad while you're watching a show, and that's pretty cool. But this does it, you know, kind of live and in real time while you're watching the show. It takes the information and just keeps updating it.
Now, is it just one screen, or I mean one extra screen, or several extra screens that you can pull out?
So what this basically does, it has one that will play along with the show. So as you're watching the show, it'll continue to play. But it also has a menu for additional content or character breakdowns and things like that. And that's stuff that you can choose to move around and explore while you're going through everything.
And that's great, because if you can't remember what some character was, this can give you the background on it and so forth. Okay, well, that sounds kind of cool. All right. Walmart same day delivery. I couldn't believe it when I was reading it. It's amazing what they're thinking about doing. I think they're trying to compete with Amazon with a complete really different delivery system. Why don't you tell us about it, Russell?
It's really funny. So Amazon and Google both have been going back and forth to see who can get stuff from the internet to our front porch faster. And right now, if you're on the West Coast, you're really lucky, because they're trying out all this stuff right now. If you're in Seattle, there's Amazon Fresh, where you can order something on Amazon Fresh, and it'll be on your doorstep within hours of having ordered it. And Google is trying to do something very similar with their same-day delivery service. But neither one of them, you know, would really be able to offer the same thing if Walmart were to get in the game and kind of offer the same kind of same-day service. But from what we can tell, there was a report that came out that one of the ways that they're looking at offering the same day service is offering a discount to in-store buyers to act as couriers and deliver the stuff to your house for them.
That's just,
So effectively, you have complete strangers when you are at the register. If you say, hey, I'd like a discount on my products to deliver things, you know, I've got My van has room for, you know, an extra bag of things, I guess. And you can take that and deliver, you know, to complete strangers for a discount on your purchase in the store. That is something that they're considering setting up. There's nothing set in stone about that right now.
Okay. So that hasn't started anywhere.
No. This is something that's just kind of being talked about as something that may happen. And honestly, I think once they realize that it's not going to work well, you know, on a long-term thing, then it's not going to continue. But
some people don't even want brownies delivering cookies to their house, let alone you know, a total stranger.
Oh, that's true. Yeah, I hadn't even thought about that, actually.
Let me ask you, is same-day delivery really something that people are asking for?
Oh, absolutely. Amazon's Amazon Prime service is an incredible service right now because you can pay the extra, you know, $4 per order, regardless of how big the order is, and have it delivered the next day. I was never really concerned about having something delivered the next day until I moved into my new house, and I realized that not only could I order the frame for the bed that I wanted online, but I could have this 150-pound frame delivered overnight for $4.
Yeah, the price
just
is
something that
unreal.
Is ridiculous.
It is unreal. It does say something about demand then. Tess in Columbus, you're on the air with Russell Holly. Welcome, Tess.
Yes. Speaking of same day delivery, my son just moved back here to Columbus after living in Brooklyn for a year and a half, and he worked as a bike messenger the entire time in Manhattan and all around. And they were in the process when he left. They were already doing it of partnering in New York City with eBay, so that when people bought something on eBay, they could have it delivered immediately by a bike messenger. And people there already will use, for instance, if I called Macy's and bought a sweater and I want it at my office, they just call a bike messenger. And, you know, maybe it's like $9 if you're in Manhattan and you're just, you know, getting something from Macy's or whatever. And people do that there all the time. But they were bringing down the cost by partnering with eBay because then they would absorb some of the cost. So that was just another example of that. And vis-a-vis Amazon, yeah, I'm a Amazon Prime addict. And even when you buy something that's a regular price item, like a replacement sonic toothbrush, say. You pay the deliver. You know, you pay maybe a little bit more, or, you know, but you get the Prime, so you get the free 2-day delivery. But I don't have to drive to Target and park and go in and, you know,
sure,
find a toothbrush and get it and bring it back home. And so I'm more than willing to pay for that convenience. And so, yeah, my husband was convinced I was a shopping addict until I explained it to him. So. Hang up and listen. Thanks.
Thank you. It's interesting to me, this the demand for this. But Tess makes sense of it to a certain degree, right?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, and it's the same thing you see with Craigslist. You know, most Craigslist transactions happen that same day, and people look them up for that very reason. You know, if you need to get rid of something, especially furniture. I see that a lot on Craigslist, where somebody puts something up on furniture that says, you know, for $100, I have to get rid of it today. You know, and even if it's a nice piece of furniture, it caters to those who, you know, are interested in that same day transaction.
My guest is Russell Holly, tech blogger for Geek.com. If you have a question or comment for Russell about something technological, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You can also go to our Facebook page and post your question or comment there. Let's move on to Make-A-Box. A6LT.
I am going to keep talking to you about 3D printers.
I know. It's like an ongoing conversation. But once again, another deftly named high-tech product. but more importantly, a new cheap 3D printer, Make-A-Box A6LT. What is it?
So the previous, you know, 3D printers that we talked about before, the big barrier to getting them in the house is that they're still a couple thousand dollars for a really good one. And really, even if you go the route of making one yourself, you know, where you've gotten parts and you've assembled it yourself, you're still looking pretty close to $700 to $800. You know, once you have all the stuff ordered and you go to actually use it, I can't figure out how, but this company is selling a 3D printer for $200.
Well, have you seen it? There's a picture of it.
I've seen a bunch of companies. I've seen a bunch of trade show presentations where they've shown it off, and I've seen videos of it, but I've not actually touched one myself. But this, you know, this company is they're right now, the way that they're able to get things as inexpensive as they are is they're based in China, where they can get the parts for incredibly cheap, and they're actually shipping straight from there.
Uh-huh.
So everything that they're getting is, you know, significantly less expensive, but they've managed to get, you know, the same quality printer that you'd be able to either, you know, source yourself or build for just under $1,000 down to $200 with, you know, very little in the way of sacrifice. And you can have them for a little extra. You can have, you know, a sturdier casing built around it, whereas it's got kind of a plexiglass casing built around it now. And you can even have the casing removed. But an interesting thing about 3D printing is that if you have a difference in air temperature or like a breeze or something like that during the printing process, then you'll actually have an uneven print when you're done. So things won't look correct.
I don't have, from the picture I can see the A6LT, I can't tell how big it is.
This is something that would be able to sit on, you know, a countertop in your kitchen. It's just about the size of a person's torso. It's not very big, but it's designed in such a way that it'll print things tall instead of being able to print them wide. Which is what a lot of the larger setups are right now.
Let's see. Sean in Columbus, you're on the air. You think you know why these printers are so cheap?
I mean, Russell probably knows this, I'm sure. But, you know, the printer industry is known for making a huge amount of money on supplies. And the cheaper the machine, the more expensive and the greater the profit on the supplies. So a lot of times these folks can, especially with ink, they can nearly give the printer away for free because the cost of the printer is made up in just one round of buying ink. And I would imagine the supplies are probably proprietary, and that's probably what they're doing with this, defraying some of the cost or the profit into when people have to buy the supply.
Makes sense, Russell?
That was something that I had considered, and it was actually the first thing that I looked for, because you see that with a couple of the companies right now where they've managed to make kind of less expensive than, say, MakerBot as their 3D printer, and they have custom cartridges that they use. But one of the other things on this website is even a system that makes the wound plastic. This is actually an unfinished project that they're working on that allows you to use plastic bits to make your own wire, which was, you know, kind of counterintuitive to a company that would want to sell their own materials, I thought. So I was definitely inclined to agree with you until I saw that, and now it's kind of hard to see where exactly they're going with it as far as how to make it profitable, because right now it doesn't seem like it would be.
Sean, thanks a lot for that call. Now, one thing we haven't mentioned, you have to build the printer yourself, right? They send you a kit?
Well, they send you the kit with everything that you need, and it's, you know, it doesn't require a ton of mechanical inclination to make something like this, because the hard parts are going to be pre-assembled. So this is going to be pretty similar to what you would get if, you know, something from IKEA, basically, where the motors and everything are assembled and you just kind of clip them into place.
Email from Sarah. She says, I was watching the show The Big Bang Theory, and they talked about 3D printing. Two of the guys bought one and spent hours making action figures of themselves. For anyone who likes The Big Bang Theory, you can enjoy that. Does it really take a long time to make something, or was that part of the joke? The printer itself on the show is about $5,000 or something crazy like that. That must be a little kind of an older Big Bang Theory, I would imagine.
No, it was, I think it was this season where they did that. It was pretty recent.
Okay.
And I definitely laughed at the episode there. What made that particular 3D printer unique and how expensive it was that it was able to, print multiple colors simultaneously, which is both why it took longer and why it was more expensive. What you see with these other, you know, kind of appliance grade 3D printers for households, They're much smaller, they're much less expensive, but they only print one color at a time. So when you get the thing that you want, you print in one color, or your design facilitates multiple colors that you have to load individually.
So who do you see really getting this? Is it necessarily a household must have yet, or what? At $200, I mean, it's not that much, but
I think it's one of those things where if you have someone in the house who is, you know, either artistically inclined or computer savvy and understands the value of being able to simply print something yourself when something is broken, or being able to create something yourself, you know, even if it's something simple. I go back to this example a lot, but even if it's something as simple as, you know, making a case for your smartphone, or a new handle, you know, when something breaks, you know, it's one of those things that, you know, if you have it, I really truly believe that people will find new uses for it as they continue to use it.
Question is, can you get it on Amazon Prime? Mark in Clintonville, you're a big Amazon Prime user. You wanted to talk about that. Welcome.
Yeah, I'm in grad school, and a lot of my work is online. And quite often, I've had to acquire books and research materials. And Amazon Prime, I mean, it's there the next day, and it's much easier than running down to one of the college bookstores here in town and wasting gas and parking and worrying about towing and everything else. It's really been a lifesaver.
What's the difference between Amazon Prime? What is it?
You just get that same day deliver, that next day delivery.
Oh, and you just pay a little bit more for it.
Yeah, $4 extra, and it's there.
Amazon Prime has a yearly subscription where it's like $60 a year or $100 a year if you are not a student, if memory serves, and you can... You unlock basically the ability to have something delivered to your house the next day. Not everything on Amazon, but participating retailers will have the ability to ship next day for an additional $4 on your purchase.
Okay. Wow. Hey, Mark, thanks a lot. Good luck with school. We just have about a minute left, but is this the 3D printer you're going to get, Russell?
It is certainly one that I've stared at long and hard and considered getting just because it's something that, you know, I'd be able to mess around with, and if I wouldn't be too concerned if I broke it.
Mm-hmm.
The problem that I have right now isn't so much getting a 3D printer. It is having one in my house that does not drive my wife crazy.
Okay.
Because it's either too big or takes up space or, you know, is you know, inappropriately placed. I have to find the best. I have to basically make a place in my house for it.
So you'll let us know when that happens.
Absolutely.
Anything else you want to talk about? We have about a minute left. Did I not ask all the questions?
I think we had one more thing to talk about, but I think we're kind of running out of time.
Too fast. Okay.
I guess really the I don't really have a whole lot else to talk about today.
Really?
Yeah, I mean, you know, we had April Fool's yesterday, and the entire internet rises up as one to hide any kind of real news.
That's right. You didn't fall for any of that, did you?
I didn't fall for any of that. And what's funny is that because it's a funny artifact of social media, because we have, you know, people in time zones all across the world communicating simultaneously,
mm-hmm.
most of these April Fool's jokes I actually saw right around midnight before I went to bed on Sunday. Because there was so much, so many people in other time zones who had already discovered them.
Okay. All right. That makes sense. Well, Russell, talk to you next week.
All right.
All right. Russell Holly, tech blogger for geek.com. Thanks to everybody for listening to Tech Tuesday today on All Sides with Ann Fisher. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher. This is listener-supported WOSU 89.7 and WOSU HD1 Columbus, and streaming on the web at WOSU.org. 89.7 NPR News, your all-day NPR news station, a service of WOSU Public Media.